Welcome to the LDN Radio Show, brought to you by the LDN Research Trust. I'm your host, Linda Elsiegood. I have an exciting lineup of guest speakers who are LDN experts in their field. We will be discussing low-dose naltrexone and its many uses in autoimmune diseases, cancers, etc. Thank you for joining us. This week, it's my pleasure to bring to you a presentation from the LDN Book Volume 2 Tour, October 2020.
Dr. Jack Monaco operates Nashville Hormone and Integrative Wellness Center. He has lectured extensively throughout the U.S., Canada, and the Middle East, and is recognized as an expert in hormone restoration, adrenal and thyroid dysfunction, autoimmunity, and intestinal dysfunction. You're about to see why. Dr. Monaco?
Thank you, Terry. Can everybody hear me okay?
Absolutely, yes.
I'll take that as a yes. I'm very honored to be part of this very important webinar. My experience with LDN started personally. You may or may not know, I'm a conventionally trained obstetrician gynecologist, and I practiced OBGYN in Connecticut for about 35 years. And I was stricken with ulcerative colitis. Like many of my family members, my mother had ulcerative colitis, my uncle. My sister died of complications of ulcerative colitis at the age of 18. So I spent about 25 years struggling with this disease. In fact, it's the reason that I gave up obstetrics and gynecology because of the night call and the stress. And I was very close to having a total colectomy. I've tried every conventional treatment that was out there, intravenous medications, rectal suppositories, you name it, the very conventional treatments. And nothing really worked for me. It was a temporizing effect. So I pursued my fellowship in anti-aging and functional medicine through the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, specifically to find a cure for me. But I was also interested in bioidentical hormones, which I had been doing since the late 90s. And it was during my fellowship that I found the path to wellness and healing for my symptoms. And I emphasized the symptoms because I could never get rid of the chronic inflammation that I had for 25 years on biopsy. And then one day I was talking to a colleague of mine, actually he was a pharmacist in Connecticut, and he mentioned LDN. So he told me a little bit about it and I researched it a little bit. And I said, okay, I'll give it a try. And I did. And a year and a half later, I had a colonoscopy and it was the first time in 25 years that my biopsies were entirely negative. There was no submucosal inflammation. There was no plasma cell infiltrate. There was nothing to suggest that I had any kind of inflammation. So I was sold not only on functional medicine, but on low-dose naltrexone. My wife takes it. I have very many patients on low-dose naltrexone. I always refer to it as the miracle drug of the 21st century because it has such a low side effect profile, as you've heard, and it has such remarkable results. So I'm going to talk today about the immune system. The immune system, as you can imagine, is very, very complicated. I'm going to be talking just very peripherally, basic immune function. We're going to talk about gut function. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about autoimmune thyroid, because that's one of the most common diseases that we see. At least that's what I see in my practice. I started out as a hormone doctor, and now about 50% of my practice is thyroid. So it's become a huge, huge part of my practice and the autoimmune nature of it. So many patients come into my office, as I'm sure Dr. Grana can tell you in her practice, that they've tried everything. The doctors aren't listening to them. All they want to do is give them a medication and they're not solving the problem. So patients come to the office seeking that real answer. So let me pull up my slides. And come on, you could do it. There we go. Okay. All right, so we're going to talk about the immune system and gut anatomy and how to treat inflammation just very, very briefly. But I really want to talk about the effects of this wonderful medication on autoimmune conditions. And we'll use the Hashimoto's thyroid as an example. So we'll talk basically about innate versus adaptive immunity. So innate immunity is that which we're born with. It's nonspecific. It's really the first line defense against invading pathogens, viruses and bacteria and the like. The immediate response, it's immediate, and nonspecific. And like most immune responses, the second go around is usually a more rapid response. And this is really the basis for vaccinations. When you look at the adaptive system, now we're looking at highly specified, specific antibody response to certain specific antigens. It's very, very precise, and there's humoral and cellular. So you've got the B lymphocytes and the T lymphocytes. Now the T lymphocytes come from the thymus gland. The thymus gland atrophies after about 8 months of after birth. But that's the basis of our cellular immunity. So when you look at the comparison, you've got these different types of cells. You've got rapid response versus slow, low potency versus high potency. So they cover both bases, the general immune function and the very specific, highly sensitive immune function. Adaptive immunity is what you see in higher level vertebrates, like humans. Now, immune tolerance, this is something that's been near and dear to my heart as an obstetrician, because this is the basis of the immune tolerance in pregnancy. Think of the fetus as a foreign antigen, if you will. And if the body did not have immune tolerance, then you would attack the fetus and nobody would reproduce. We wouldn't have a human race. So this is something that is given to us to protect us against self-antigens, autoimmunity. In autoimmunity, you lose some of that tolerance, and that's the basis for autoimmune response. Most common reason that I see is food allergies. We're going to talk a little bit about food allergies as well. So autoimmunity is really the body's trying to do something good for us, but it's doing something bad. So as we all know in medical school, Hippocrates, let your food be your medicine and your medicine is your food. In my household, I grew up in an Italian Arabic family. So my grandmother, the Italian grandmother, would say, you are what you eat. And my father would say, some people eat to live and some people like me live to eat. And that's true because I grew up with some of the best food in the world. So I was not a very thin person when I was younger. I've been struggling all my life. So we've talked about food. This is really the basis of my practice outside of the hormones. So when I talk to my patients about thyroid and adrenal dysfunction and gut and autoimmunity, it's really the key really is the food. So you think of the food as a signal, to the cell, to the cellular mechanism and the nucleus, to the messenger RNA and protein synthesis, and you get a certain response. If you put a different food in, you're going to have the same process, but you're going to get a different response. And it's not necessarily the best response, of course. So when you look at the incidence of these diseases, about 5 to 8% of the US population is diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. In my practice, it seems like it's a bit higher. It seems like it's more like 15 to 20%. And as was mentioned by Linda, there are many, many immune disorders, not the 30 or 40 that we learned about in medical school. So one in six Americans is estimated to suffer from early stage autoimmunity. That's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. And a lot of times these folks aren't recognized. Doctors are not really addressing their problem. They're treating their symptoms. So when you look at the leading causes of illness and death, after cardiovascular disease and cancer, autoimmunity is the third leading cause. So let's look at leaky gut. We've all heard that term, leaky gut. If you say that to a gastroenterologist, they'll likely dismiss you. But if you say hyperpermeability, then they'll probably at least listen to you. And autoimmunity is really found in the gut. About 80 to 90% of our immune function is located in our GI tract. So this is a electron photomicrograph of the small intestine in cross section, okay? So when you look at the length, we all, if you've been in medical school or even in pharmacy school, I'm sure you've heard these types of numbers where the intestine is very, very long, 25 to 30 feet in our abdomen. But the surface area is infinitely larger. It has about 100 square meters of surface area, the size of a tennis court. So how does that happen? Well, you've got these villi, they're folds. So these folds here, where's my pointer? There we are. So these folds here are the villi. So that increases the surface area, the absorptive area in the intestine. But they're covered by microvilli, which further increases that absorptive area. So the primary functions of the GI tract, digestion, absorption of nutrients, metabolism and detoxification. And when you think about this, I tell this to my patients, and sometimes I see the blank look on their face because they don't really catch it. The endothelium of the gut separates the outside of the body from the inside of the body. The intestines are inside your abdomen, but the contents of those intestines are separate from the inside of the body. A ruptured appendix is a perfect example. You get the contents of the intestines into the abdominal cavity, and you get overwhelming infection, sepsis, and death if it's not treated. So this barrier, this endothelium, is critical for health. So when you look at the section, these are the villi, and then on top of that are the microvilli, adding even more surface area, and this is where the absorption occurs, passing through the endothelium into the capillary, and then into the lymphatics if necessary. And then you look even further, here's the single cell layer of endothelium, okay? And we've all heard this term, tight junction. And that's what we're going to be looking at next. Okay. So this is an article that was in Scientific American, and I put this up here because of the author's comment. Okay, this Dr. Alessio Fasano. And this is what I learned, how I was told in medical school. He and I think, went to the medical school around the same time in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. We were told that the small intestine was nothing more than a conduit with a single cell layer with tiles and grout known as tight junctions. And that's all there was to it. Well, we know today that there are some amazing biochemical reactions occurring in that tight junction. Okay. So when you look at this article from the Department of Cell Biology in the United Kingdom, they say here that there's a lot of things happening. Junctional elements, proteins, dynamic properties are important in the tight junction function. So there's a lot of things happening in that tight junction. You disrupt the tight junction, you disrupt the normal homeostasis of the gut and the immune system. So here's an example of just some of the things that could be going on inside the tight junction. So, here's a healthy, normal tight junction. Now you separate, you open this up either with inflammation or food allergy or abnormal bacteria, toxins, and you start to get things that are meant to be absorbed and stay in the body can leak out, and you have things that were meant to be excreted that can leak back in. And those things that leak back in are sometimes referred to as circulating immune complexes. So they can stimulate the immune system to do things that we don't want it to do. So let's look at the process of the gut-brain-heart connection, okay? This was a real eye-opener for me. I was actually taking a course for my master's, and I was in the gut module. And I was sitting next to a colleague of mine, Mark Houston. And we were talking about this. And for those of you who don't know Mark, he is a hypertensive expert in cardiovascular disease. And he said, the endothelial lining of the gut, the brain, and the blood vessels are identical. You inflame one, you can increase inflammation in the others and increase disease. So we know that people that have inflammatory bowel disease or that have celiac disease or any kind of inflammation in the gut, Crohn's, pick a gut inflammation, they have a higher incidence of certain cancers, but also cardiovascular disease and cognitive decline. So healing the gut lining not only helps with the gut symptoms and autoimmunity, can actually help with some of these other comorbidities. So anything that affects the gut will also affect the brain and the blood vessels and increasing those risks. So as I said, I was going to talk about Hashimoto's. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about Hashimoto's. It's an autoimmune disease. It's one of the most common autoimmune diseases. In fact, it was the first described autoimmune disease. It was described by a Japanese surgeon, Dr. Hakuro Hashimoto, in 1912. And it was has a different variety of names: chronic thyroiditis, lymphocytic thyroiditis, lymphadenitis or lymphadenoid thyroiditis, autoimmune thyroiditis, or he called it struma lymphomatosa. The basis of this process was really not well described, not well understood. In fact, when I went through medical school, the conventional treatment was to suppress the thyroid, which is not necessarily a bad thing to do, but it doesn't really get to the underlying cause of autoimmune thyroid. My patients come in from their endocrinologist or their primary care doctor, and they're told, we don't know what causes it. There's nothing we can do. You're just going to have to live with it. You're going to take this levothyroxine for the rest of your life. It's going to suppress your thyroid. Well, there are many, many other things that we can do to address this issue. And we're going to talk about some of those things. First recognized autoimmune condition, as I said, it affects 10% of the population. Truthfully, I think it affects a higher percentage. I think my practice is much higher than that, maybe 15 to 18%. They say it's 7 to 1 female to male. I probably have 2 or 3 men in my practice, and I have hundreds of women with autoimmune thyroid. So I think that's probably an underestimate of the ratio of female to male. I've seen thyroid problems begin after pregnancy. And again, it might have something to do with the privileged state of the immune system during pregnancy. When you take that away, now the immune system can reactivate. So I've seen several patients, many patients actually, who have had hypothyroidism, and we end up having to treat them. I'm seeing a lot of menopausal patients, as you can imagine, because I am a hormone doc. So I see a lot of patients in perimenopause and menopause. And a lot of those patients, I check everybody's thyroid, and the vast majority of those people will have some kind of functional hypothyroidism. They may have a normal TSH and a T4, but when you look at all the other parameters that we check in the thyroid, we find that they have suboptimal thyroid function. Some of these patients may be iodine deficient, and we're going to talk about iodine in autoimmunity as well. Some of these patients will have normal lab tests, but they have a lot of symptoms and their doctors will not treat them. So they come in and we'll treat them because we know that it's the function that's important. It's not necessarily the lab test. And we're taught in medical school to treat to make symptoms go away. The other thing that's important with autoimmunity and with particularly thyroid is the adrenal system. The adrenals are the basis of immune function. They work very closely. So with my patients, we check their adrenals as well. And the vast majority of those patients will have some adrenal dysfunction. Now, this is the explanation that is often given for what causes autoimmune thyroid. Oops, I didn't want to do that. The thyroid cells are damaged by a trigger. Well, what's that trigger? it's probably one of those circulating immune complexes or something else, some antigen or some inflammatory cytokine. The dying cells send out a signal, the immune cells come to the rescue, and what ends up happening is the immune system starts to attack the thyroid instead. Eventually, if you don't do something, the thyroid will be destroyed and the patient will be on thyroid medication for the rest of their lives. What I explain to patients, or how I think of it, maybe it's very simplistic, is that when your gut is leaky and those circulating immune complexes get in, they're partially digested proteins or partially digested food particles or whatever they may be. There may be some antigenic stimulation to the thyroid cell, the thyrocytes, that the antibodies can't distinguish between those circulating immune complexes or the thyroid cells. Now, maybe it's the circulating immune complexes that are causing the thyroid damage that's signaling help to the immune system. The bottom line, got to treat the gut. So we see a genetic predisposition. Like my autoimmune condition was ulcerative colitis. And I had several family members. In my ethnic background, inflammatory bowel disease is very, very common. So as I said, I had several relatives with ulcerative colitis. Or that trigger, the antigen that we talked about, and of course, intestinal permeability really is the bottom line. So when you look at Hashimoto's, there's really no specific pathogen. It's not a bacterial infection necessarily, but these other triggers can do this. I test all of my Hashimoto patients for iodine deficiency. Why? Because the use of iodine in autoimmune thyroid is controversial. Too much iodine, you can cause hyperthyroidism, you can increase autoimmunity, because iodine in its metabolism generates hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is an oxidant that's going to increase inflammation. If iodine is low, then you're going to have more goiter. So again, a lot of times patients will present with a multinodular goiter, and the treatment for that is to remove the thyroid, when in reality, they may have some of these underlying triggers that are causing that. Stress is huge, especially in this year with everything that's going on, toxins and dysbiosis. So we have a whole gut plan that we do for our patients. And I realize I'm not talking a lot about LDN yet. I will get to that. LDN is really the cornerstone for treating my patients' autoimmune thyroid and their gut issues. Zonulin is a protein that's made in the tight junction. So zonulin can be used to assess how leaky the gut is. And there are several companies that will do zonulin tests. The one that I do an advanced intestinal barrier assessment that looks at zonulin, histamine, and diamine oxidase. Diamine oxidase is the enzyme that digests histamine. It also looks at lipopolysaccharides that assess the function of the immune system. So we're looking at lipopolysaccharides, IgG, IgM, and IgA. Patients who have multiple sclerosis, type 1 diabetes, celiac disease, these are all autoimmune conditions. In fact, the last conference that I went to, and I think it's even higher now since then, this was about 6 months ago, the presenter said that there's now scientific data to support the use of low-dose naltrexone in 163 medical conditions. And I know Linda just talked about over 200. The problem, conventional medicine doesn't understand how something can be so effective in these seemingly unrelated conditions, can be inexpensive with such a low side effect profile. And the common denominator is the gut. So when we talk about the autoimmune system, we always think about the gut. So these are some of the things that will release zonulin, gliadin, or gluten. Gluten can cause that inflammation in the gut, cause leaky gut. Food intolerances, again, food is the number one reason that I see for autoimmunity. Stresses, unsaturated fats, drugs, alcohol, pathogenic bacteria. So our stool analysis is constantly looking at, we look at commensal bacteria, pathogenic bacteria, normal bacteria. We look at yeast and we look at parasites as well. SIBO, a lot of patients are not diagnosed because they're not aware of the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. AGEs, advanced glycated end products. Those are one of the more important compounds that will damage cholesterol and lead to endothelial dysfunction and coronary artery disease, among other things. Got two slides, three slides. There we go. Okay. So how do you test for this? There's a company, I don't know, Terry, are we, is this a...
This is not CE, you're good.
Thank you. You read my mind. Okay. So there's a company that we've been using called Dunwoody Laboratories. And I understand that they just changed their name. They must have been bought out or merged, and they're revamping things. But they were the only company that I came across that does that advanced intestinal barrier permeability. It's a blood test, a fasting blood test. And they look at zonulin, and they look at, as I said, histamine and diamine oxidase, the enzyme that digests that, and the lipopolysaccharides. And that gives us a good indicator of what the status of the endothelium is in the gut. Now, the nice thing about zonulin is that you can use that to track progress. I have a, well, he's now 18, but I started treating him when he was 16. And he and his father both have severe gut problems. His dad is a very well-known Christian singer who is unable to tour now because he's had multiple operations for Crohn's disease, had most of his small intestine removed. So we put him on some low-dose naltrexone. His son was 16 when I first met him. He weighed 87 pounds. There were only about five or eight foods that he could eat. He was reacting to everything. His zonulin was the highest I've ever seen. So we cleaned up his diet. We gave him some medical foods to help heal the gut, put him on some low-dose naltrexone. And the last time I saw him about a year ago, he came in for his annual. He was almost 100 pounds. He was in the high 90s. And he had increased the amount of foods that he could eat, and he was thriving. He was feeling much better. So I think the low-dose naltrexone was the key for healing him. Now, there is a test that you can do called the mannitol lactose intestinal permeability test. And the basis is this. Lactulose is a disaccharide, and it's not very well absorbed. So if you take lactulose by mouth, it's going to be excreted primarily in the stool. Mannitol, however, is very well absorbed. So if you give a known quantity of lactulose and mannitol, and then you measure urinary excretion, not stool excretion, but urinary excretion, the theory is this. If you have leaky gut, then the lactulose will get into the body, into the blood system, and then be excreted in the urine. So if you see a high lactulose mannitol ratio, that's another presumptive test that you have leaky gut. Now, these antibodies, as you know, have memory. IgM is a very rapid onset, very short-lived. It usually comes on within a day or so of an infection and is usually gone by 12 to 14 days, where the IgG antibodies come in a couple of days later, and they're the ones that last longer. So when you're treating somebody and you want to remove, let's say you put them on a gluten-free, dairy-free diet, but they're not celiac patients. They just have a gluten intolerance. And other foods that you remove from their diet, you want to keep them off those foods for a minimum of 6 months. And then if they want to reintroduce them, one at a time, you reintroduce them. That's the basis of the elimination diet. So you eliminate what they're sensitive to, and then you heal the gut with medical foods. And we'll talk more about that process. So how do you reverse this? Well, this is the basis of the 4R program, if you will. what I learned in my functional medicine training: remove, repair, replace, repopulate. They've added a fifth R, rebalance, but I like to stick with the four R's. So you remove what is causing the problem. You stop that thyroid expression, the antibody expression. You stop the autoimmunity or the stimulus. In order to do that, you have to identify what those triggers are. That's the basis of the food allergy testing that we do. And then you want to repair the damage and restore the lost nutrients. And we use medical foods for that. For those of you that may not be familiar with medical foods are nutrients that have been researched. They're somewhere between a nutrient and a prescription drug. A nutrient, you can get over the counter, but they can't make any claims. Prescription drugs go through the FDA trial process, which is very expensive, but they can make claims. So you can say that, this drug will cure this problem or treat this problem. Medical foods have gone through FDA testing, and they can make claims, but you don't need a prescription for them. However, the companies generally request that you're under the care of a doctor because these foods are like drugs. They can treat illness. Some of the things that you might see are hops extracts, you know, rheas and theas, those types of things. Those things affect the cytokine response in the gut lining. So they actually can heal the gut. This is what I did when I went to my first functional medicine conference, and I said, this is what I've got to do. So I started taking these medical foods. I started eliminating things and started using some other nutrients that we can talk about if time allows. The last thing is to repopulate with good quality probiotics. The three main beneficial bacteria that we see in the gut: Bifidobacter is the main anaerobe, lactobacilli, and non-pathogenic E. coli, not the kind of E. coli that comes over the border on lettuce. Very often I'll see an imbalance of a deficiency or complete absence of Bifidobacter or lactobacilli. Sometimes we'll see a normal E. coli or a deficiency. So we replace those with probiotics. And I like to use two different probiotics so that you don't develop a tolerance to them. So I'll have patients like do a 1 month of this probiotic, another month of that probiotic. Sometimes we can use decoys like Thytrophin PMG. What Thytrophin PMG is, it's very similar in its antigenic signal to the thyroid cell. And the theory there is that it distracts the antibodies from the thyroid, and the antibodies attached to this decoy, so it does not induce the immune reaction that you see in the thyroid. So when you look at the thyroid, you can have a lot of different presentations. And again, what's the common denominator with all of these different symptoms? It's the gut. So a lot of times it's not recognized when patients come in and they have these symptoms, like Linda was describing all of these symptoms that nobody could put their finger on. And really, she ended up having a bona fide problem that was an autoimmune condition. And treating it with LDN was her saving grace. We talked about iodine a little bit. So 150 micrograms is what's considered the daily requirement. But as I said, if you get too much iodine, you stimulate the immune system because of the hydrogen peroxide that's generated when you have excess iodine, when you metabolize iodine. I give selenium methionine, that helps to neutralize the hydrogen peroxide back to water. If you have not enough iodine, now your thyroid can't make thyroid hormone because it needs iodine for that process. So the brain will overstimulate the thyroid to make more thyroid hormone, and that's where you can get the goiter. So just the right amount of iodine is important. Now, I've had endocrinologists be very critical of giving somebody with autoimmune thyroid iodine But what I tell them is we measure the levels. If they're deficient, we give them small doses to get them into the optimal range. We're not going to overstimulate it. You're not going to see the reaction that you see it's not the Wolf-Chekhov reaction where they took iodine out of our body, out of our food because of hyperthyroidism. So we become iodine deficient because we have other halides in our diet. If you don't have a whole house water filter, there's chloride in your water, there's fluoride in the water and in toothpaste. Every time you take a hot shower, you're going to inhale chlorine and fluoride gas. Those are going to compete with iodine. So people can be relatively iodine deficient. So I check iodine just about on everybody, but especially on my autoimmune patients, I check their iodine because I know it's going to be an important thing to optimize. So these are some of the other immune conditions. Linda gave you a very, very long list of autoimmune conditions. So we'll just go through these. Now, how do you diagnose the thyroid for the clinicians in the audience? You can do an ultrasound. I do 12 tests on the thyroid. I don't just do a T4 and a TSH. That's what we're taught to do in medical school. And that doesn't tell you anything about function. So I'm interested in seeing what the relationship of T4 is to T3. And like all of these hormones, there's a binder that carries the thyroid binding globulin for the thyroid. And you need to know, I think you need to know what that number is so you can determine a total T4 or total T3 doesn't necessarily tell you what's available to the cell. It's about the hormone that is able to stimulate the receptor on the cell. So the thyroid binding globulin in pregnancy, for instance, goes very, very high. So you'll see upper normal total thyroid numbers, but you'll see low free thyroid numbers. So the thyroid binding globulin for me is an important test. So let's talk a little bit about low dose naltrexone. You've already heard about Dr. Bahari. I was very traditionally introduced to LDN. I've been taking LDN now for 6.5 years. And back when I started on it, it was 1.5, 3, 4.5 immediate release, and it had to be taken at night because it didn't work during the day. It only worked between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. Today, as you've heard from Terry, there's microdosing, there's ultra microdosing, twice a day dosing. I've got a couple of people now that weren't responding to 4.5. I put them on twice a day dosing. That was just recent, so I don't know what the response is going to be just yet. But we're finding out more and more about low-dose naltrexone and different doses. So the website that Linda showed, I think is excellent. I've never heard of that website. I'm going to go to that website as soon as we're done, and I'm going to start researching the different doses and some of the papers that are there, because I realized that my knowledge of LDN has to grow more. There are more conditions that I could use LDN in different doses than what I was traditionally using. So I'm very excited about going to that website. Now, Dr. Grana mentioned Dr. Smith's study. She was the first one to publish a clinical trial, and this was done in 2007. And what she found with low-dose naltrexone, that she, of her Crohn's patients and inflammatory bowel patients, 2/3 of them went into remission and 89% responded, which is tremendous. All right. This is a picture that you can see on the low-dose naltrexone website. The left picture is a picture of her patients with Crohn's colitis. The other picture on the right is the same patient 4 weeks later. Like Dr. Grana said, not 6 years or 6 months or that. It's 4 weeks later. It was amazing, this response. So I'm a firm believer in low-dose naltrexone. And when you have a pharmacist like Terry who's available to help you if you're a clinician, you can bet that's the person to call. So we've already seen how it works. You've heard about the endorphin levels and so on, so I'm not going to go through that again. but it works for me with autoimmune thyroid, for instance, works best in combination with a leaky gut diet. And that's what I had mentioned to you. Remove, repair, replace, repopulate. These patients must be gluten-free. Even if they're only mildly sensitive to gluten, I tell them to stop taking gluten. If you are familiar with, there's a neurologist down in Naples, Florida. His name is David Perlmutter. And I don't get paid by David. I am not getting a kickback. But he wrote a book called Grain Brain. And he talks about, even in normal people, what gluten does in the brain. So I would highly recommend, if you have patients, even if they're not tested to be celiac or gluten intolerant, I would have them be gluten-free. Now, they don't have to be gluten-free for the rest of their lives necessarily, but they can certainly make that attempt. I lasted 3 weeks being gluten-free. It's very, very difficult. Fortunately, today, there are companies that are making enzymes that will digest gluten. So there's a lot of cross-contamination with gluten. For instance, toothpaste, shampoos, conditioners, Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts coffee, fake crab, just to name a few. Here in Nashville, in Middle Tennessee, we have a pizza place that will give you a gluten-free crust, and the pizza place doesn't cook the pizza. You take it home and cook it, which, when you think about it, kind of makes a lot of sense. You know, you take the pizza home, by the time you get it home, it's cold. So I watch these high school and college kids serving up these gluten-free crusts. And what they do is they go in the back and they get the gluten-free crust. They don't change the gloves that they were wearing when they were dealing with the gluten pizzas. They unwrap it. They put it on the same counter that they did the other pizzas. They roll the dough out, and then they put their hands in the same buckets that they have all the ingredients in, and they wrap it up and call it gluten-free, okay? Well, yes, the inoculum is going to be much, much less. You're not eating a gluten crust, but you're still, if you're like my stepdaughter who has celiac disease, she's exquisitely sensitive to gluten. So she will take gluten digest or some enzyme before she has any possibility of contamination. So even if you go to a restaurant that says they have a gluten-free menu, be suspicious. If you have patients that are gluten sensitive or celiac, they really should take these enzymes with them to prevent the re-stimulation of the immune system with the gluten. So in the New England Journal of Medicine, and again, doctors say that there's not a lot of evidence for this. It's got to be evidence-based, where we're seeing more and more articles in prestigious journals like the New England Journal. So they talk about the immune modulation that was alluded to by Terry very, very nicely. So that's really how this works. I'm a clinician, so I look at the clinical response. I want my patients to get better. And I rely on guys like Terry to tell me, okay, this is what we got to do. So he talked about the opiate receptors and the brief blockade that occurs between, now they say here 2 and 4 a.m. So I think the jury's probably still out on the exact timing. And now that they've recommended using other formulations of LDN, not just the 1.5 to 4.5 and doing it multiple times a day, I think there's a lot about this that we still have to learn. So as Terry mentioned, there's two isomers, the levo and the dextro. I'm not gonna repeat this in detail, but the levo isomer is the one that blocks the opiate receptors, but it's the dextro one that has an effect on the immune system. And these toll-like receptors, which are classes of proteins that work with the innate immune system, not the adaptive immune system. So they are pattern recognition receptors, and they work with these different receptors that we find in the gut that can be expressed either by pathogens or by dead or dying cells. So when you have somebody who has inflammatory bowel, for instance, there's a lot of necrosis, a lot of inflammation going on, and that can stimulate these DAMPs, these molecular pattern receptors, to stimulate the immune system. So I went through this list. I'll go through this list very quickly because on the website that Linda mentioned, there's a very, very comprehensive list of autoimmune conditions, but anything from Lou Gehrig's disease up to multiple sclerosis, celiac disease, skin manifestations. Somebody comes in and has rosacea or psoriasis, those people get a gut evaluation rather than give them an immune suppressive drug and a steroid. You find the cause of the problem, and a lot of times that will improve. I did a lot of surgery for endometriosis. Had I only known that it was an autoimmune condition and that there was LDN, but didn't happen, wasn't aware of it. Did a lot of surgery for that. Cancers. All these different autoimmune conditions. I've seen more patients now since I started doing functional medicine in Nashville that have Sjogren's syndrome. I don't think I saw a case of Sjogren's since I was a medical student on my medical rotation. And then I come to Nashville and I've already seen, I think, five or six people with Sjogren's syndrome. I have one patient with sarcoid that was so bad, and we got him on low-dose naltrexone, and he is now not only functional, he's actually doing well. His calcium levels are fine, and his doctor says, you know, I don't know what to do. And he says, don't worry about it. He said, Dr. Monaco's got it under control. So we've actually helped him a lot with his sarcoid. And cancers. Imagine the autoimmune impact on cell health and cancer. We can make such an impact on so many of these conditions with low-dose naltrexone. As you've heard, virtually no side effects. When I started on LDN, I started at 1.5 only because I don't have autoimmune thyroid, but I wanted to see what it was like. So I started at 1.5, and maybe I had a little bit of disrupted sleep for a couple of days. And then after a month, I went up to 3. And then after a month, I went up to 4.5. And I've been on 4.5 ever since. I did not feel any different because I was not having symptoms. Now, my colitis symptoms were under control. I had perfectly normal bowel function. I had no symptoms. The proof of the pudding for me was when I had my colonoscopy and the biopsies were negative. First time, 25 years. And I attribute it to the LDN. There's no other reason for that because I've tried everything else. So LDN is one of the things that is a big part of my practice. Now, do I have patients that can't tolerate it? Yes, I do. Some of those patients, I've got one patient that's on 0.5. I've got one patient that won't go or can't go above 2 milligrams. So as Terry mentioned, whatever works, okay? If that doesn't work, then you cut the dose back, you try different things. But I encourage them not to give up. It's so inexpensive that it's not like they have a financial reason not to do this. Some may, but it's not like they're spending thousands of dollars for the conventional treatment. My one Remicade injection was $4,800. Fortunately, insurance paid for that. So it's been approved at the 50 milligram dose. And we used a lot of naltrexone, actually Narcan, in the delivery room. So we would deliver a baby. Mom's had a long labor. She gets sectioned or whatever. And she's baby's full of narcotics. It's really floppy. Pediatric nurse gives her a little bit of Narcan. And the baby's screaming and wailing. So I've always thought of Narcan as just that, as an opiate blocker. But now the research is just is coming out in droves. So it's keep it in mind. It's very important. This is the website for low-dose naltrexone. I encourage you to go there. It's a very, very well-designed website. I gave a talk similar to this 2 years ago at PCCA's International Convention. And the man who worked with Dr. Bahari on the research and who designed the website was in the audience. And he he raised his hand and he told me who he was. And I asked him to please tell me the story. So he took about 10 minutes to tell me the story of how this came about. And Terry did a very nice job of going over that information. So I encourage you to go look at this website. There's a lot of good information on there. That's where I am. I'm in Franklin, Tennessee, which is just outside of Nashville. If you've never been to Nashville, come as soon as you can. It's a great place. That's my website. If you have any questions, there's my phone number. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Monaco. Excellent, excellent. I would comment just a little bit on what you talked about with dose timing and some of the questions that come about because of that. Mm-hmm. This issue of data that shows the release of endorphins at night within certain time frames and dosing at night, we now are seeing more and more about some physicians getting patients in the morning or moving them to morning if they have these symptoms at night at all. But patients still seem to be responsive. Now, I can't respond, of course, for every patient, but like you shared your journey, a couple of years ago, I found my thyroid antibodies elevated, went on low-dose naltrexone to address that. I wasn't feeling any symptom. I didn't feel any different being on it, but my antibodies came back down to nothing. But at the time that I began, I had just had surgery moving the foot of my colon, and that was disrupting my sleep. So I started in the morning, and I've continued in the morning, and my antibodies came down anyway. So I feel like there's still value, even if it's not able to be taken at night in some situations. Appreciate your presentation and your expertise. This was excellent.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to get to that last slide if anybody wants the information, and my computer's just running really slow. Give me 1 second, I'll get there.
Sure, sure.
I tried to do it the other way, and it just kept going back to the title slide.
Yeah.
Oh boy. I can't see the question bar here. So yeah, I don't know if anybody has any questions.
I don't see one there. I would ask you one myself. And ask if you will comment a little bit of the slide you just passed about the thyroid dosing. A little bit of comment on the controversy and addressing both sides of that a little bit. For example, Dr. Pam Smith talks about needing about 5 milligrams a day to prevent breast cancer risk. And how do we reconcile the differences in those two?
5 milligrams of what?
Of iodine.
Of iodine. Okay. Yeah, with autoimmune thyroid, I go by the numbers. If somebody is deficient, I'll give them 10 milligrams a day for a month, and then I put them on a maintenance dose of 10 milligrams a week. If they're just low, suboptimal, they're in the lower normal range, and I do a dried urine test. The dried urine test, here we go, look at this. If I do a dried urine test, uh-huh. And the reference range for the dried urine test is 100 to 380. So if they're under 100, they're deficient, I give them high dose. If they're between 100 and 200, I'll give them a lesser dose of a liquid iodine. And if they're over 200, they're optimal, but I give them all a sheet that has foods that contain iodine. So yes, for breast cancer, you need a little bit higher dosing.
Yes,
but right. You gotta be careful. You gotta be careful with the thyroid. That was just for the thyroid, for autoimmune thyroid, because of the iodine metabolism.
Okay, thanks. I wanted to appreciate you addressing that because I know that there are some questions out there about that process. And I see you have your slide on the screen that has your contact information. Yep. And this will also be continued in the, or be contained within the video when that is ready as well. If you fail to get this information and you need another access to it, you can get in touch with us and we'll put you back in touch with Dr. Monaco.
Okay, great.
So we'll move on then if we don't have other questions.
Thank you again, Terry.
Thank you. We appreciate you very much.
Yes, sir.
Any questions or comments you may have, please email me, Linda, L-I-N-D-A, at ldnrt.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciated your company. Until next time, stay safe and keep well.